Hello, I'm Sebastian. Welcome to Nine Gnar Trees podcast. Today, I will summarize and review the book. The Seven Laws of Teaching by John Knowlton Gregory is a classic work on educational method first published in the late 19th century and still widely read in teacher training, Christian education, and classical education circles. Rather than offering a modern research manual or a collection of classroom tactics, the book sets out a concise philosophy of teaching built around seven basic laws. Gregory argues that effective instruction depends on a few permanent conditions: a knowledgeable teacher, an attentive learner, clear language, a definite lesson, active teaching, active learning, and steady review. Its style reflects its era, but its purpose remains recognizable today. Gregory wants teachers to understand what must be true for learning to happen at all. Because of that, the book works both as a practical guide and as a framework for thinking about instruction more deeply. Its lasting appeal comes from its clarity, brevity, and confidence that sound teaching principles apply across subjects, ages, and settings. I will give you key takeaways from this book. Firstly, the book begins with teaching as a disciplined craft. A central strength of the Seven Laws of Teaching is that it treats teaching as a serious craft governed by intelligible principles. Gregory does not describe good teaching as a matter of personality, charisma, or improvisation alone. He insists that instruction succeeds when certain conditions are present and fails when they are neglected. This gives the book a firm, orderly structure. The seven laws are not random tips, but an attempt to identify the essential elements involved whenever one mind helps another learn. That approach explains why the book has remained influential long after many narrower manuals have faded. Gregory also writes with unusual economy. He reduces the complexity of classroom work into a framework that is simple enough to remember, but broad enough to apply in many contexts. Whether the setting is a schoolroom, church class, homeschool, or informal tutoring environment, his argument is that the same governing realities still matter. A teacher must know, a learner must attend, meaning must be shared, and learning must be confirmed. This foundational quality is one reason the book is often valued by educators who want first principles rather than trends. Its method encourages teachers to examine not only what they teach, but what teaching itself really requires. Secondly, teacher knowledge and learner attention form the starting point. Two of Gregory's most basic laws concern the teacher and the learner. The first is that the teacher must know the lesson or truth to be taught. This is more than a demand for minimal competence. Gregory presents subject mastery as a moral and professional obligation. A teacher who only half understands a lesson cannot explain it clearly, adapt it wisely, or answer confusion with confidence. The book's emphasis on preparation still feels current because weak teaching often begins in weak understanding. The matching law is that the learner must attend with interest to the lesson. Gregory, therefore, rejects the idea that instruction is merely the transfer of information from an active speaker to passive listeners. Attention is not optional decoration added to learning after the fact. It is part of the condition for learning itself. This makes the relationship between teacher and student more dynamic than a lecture-centered model might suggest. The teacher must work in ways that awaken and direct interest, while the learner must engage mentally with what is being taught. Taken together, these two laws establish the human core of the book. Teaching begins with a prepared mind meeting an attentive mind. Gregory's point is simple, but demanding deep knowledge and genuine attention are not extras. They are the first requirements of meaningful instruction. Shared language and a clear lesson make understanding possible. Gregory gives major importance to language and lesson clarity because understanding cannot occur without them. His law of language states that teacher and learner must share a common medium of communication. In practice, this means the teacher must use words that the learner can actually grasp. Technical terms, vague abstractions, and unexplained expressions create the illusion of teaching while leaving the learner behind. Gregory, therefore, treats language not as a decorative feature of instruction, but as one of its governing conditions. Closely connected is the law of the lesson, which requires that the lesson itself be clear and well-defined. A confused teacher often presents a blurred subject, and a blurred subject leads to scattered thinking in the learner. Gregory wants teachers to identify what is being taught, distinguish central truth from secondary detail, and move in an orderly way toward understanding. This is part of why the book remains useful for educators in many traditions. It offers a reminder that confusion is not depth, and that clarity is not simplification in the negative sense. These laws also show Gregory's practical realism. Students do not learn merely because important material is placed before them. They learn when ideas are communicated in accessible language and arranged with purpose. The teacher must therefore translate knowledge into teachable form without emptying it of substance. Fourthly, teaching and learning are active processes, not passive events. One of the book's most enduring ideas is Gregory's treatment of teaching and learning as active mental work. his law of the teaching process describes teaching as the act of arousing and guiding the self-activities of another mind. This means the teacher does not simply pour knowledge into a student. Instead, the teacher stimulates thought, directs attention, asks for response, and helps the learner participate in the act of understanding. This view gives the student a more active role than some readers might expect from a 19th century text. The companion law of learning states that the learner must reproduce ideas accurately in his or her own understanding. In other words, learning happens when the student truly grasps and mentally reforms the material rather than merely hearing it. Gregory is therefore interested in inward comprehension, not verbal repetition alone. A student who can echo words without understanding has not yet completed the work of learning. This emphasis helps explain why many readers still find the book fresh. Gregory anticipates later concerns about engagement, participation, and student ownership without using modern educational jargon. He sees the classroom as a place where minds must be awakened into action. The teacher guides that action, but cannot replace it. Real instruction depends on the learner thinking, connecting, and internalizing truth through active effort. Lastly, review and reinforcement complete the work of instruction. Gregory's final law concerns review, and it gives the book a notably practical conclusion. He argues that teaching is not complete when a lesson has been presented, or even when it seems to have been understood once. Knowledge must be revisited, tested, confirmed, and applied. Review fastens learning by bringing ideas back to the mind, connecting them to previous lessons, and exposing weak points before they harden into failure. This law reflects Gregory's belief that memory and mastery require deliberate reinforcement. The importance of this point is easy to miss in settings that prioritize coverage over retention. Gregory is less impressed by how much content a teacher can move through than by whether truth has genuinely taken root in the learner. Review is therefore not mere repetition for its own sake. It is part of the learning process because it strengthens understanding and checks whether teaching has succeeded. This law also broadens the book's usefulness. It applies to formal exams, oral questioning, discussion, recitation, and practical application. What matters is that the learner returns to the material in ways that deepen possession of it. Gregory closes his system with review because he sees education as cumulative. Lessons should not vanish after first exposure. They should become part of the learner's settled understanding through repeated contact and thoughtful use. In conclusion, The Seven Laws of Teaching is best suited for teachers, tutors, school leaders, homeschooling parents, and church educators who want a concise statement of the permanent conditions of good instruction. It is especially valuable for readers who prefer first principles over rapidly changing educational fashion. Those looking for a modern handbook full of current terminology, data, or highly specific classroom systems may find it less detailed in those areas. Even so, its practical value remains strong because Gregory focuses on realities that still shape every learning environment. The book's benefits are both intellectual and practical. Intellectually, it helps readers think clearly about what teaching is and what must happen for learning to occur. Practically, it sharpens habits of preparation, clarity, questioning, learner engagement, and review. Many books on teaching emphasize techniques. Gregory stands out by organizing the whole task around a small set of durable laws. That gives the reader a framework rather than a passing method. Its enduring reputation comes from this unusual combination of brevity, seriousness, and applicability. Though written in an older style and often embraced in Christian and classical circles, its core insights extend far beyond one educational niche. For anyone who wants to teach more thoughtfully and with greater intentionality, it remains a compact and influential classic. If you would like to support John Knowlton Gregory, you can buy the book through the Amazon link I've provided in the podcast description. After reading the book, please let me know what you think and share your thoughts. See you around.